Blog Hello and welcome to Awakenings. That was a bit of Pure Energy by Beth Greene, which I thought was really appropriate for our talk today on Awakenings. I'm your host, Michelle Mache, and I want to welcome everyone that is already coming on the line and also in the chat room. Hello and welcome, everyone. And welcome to those that are listening via CosmicDimensions.com, another podcast outlet, music station that we broadcast live from, and welcome those that are going to be listening to the archives later on via iTunes and the other podcast stations. You are here with us now, even though you're listening later. Awakenings Radio hosts dialogues and interviews with spiritual teachers, healers, conscious experts, visionaries, awakened leaders, authors, and conscious beings of all walks of life, people that are waking up or awake and integrating this awakened state in their everyday lives. Awakenings reflects the bridging point between science and spirituality, and Awakenings is a place for guidance to support and guide you through the shifts and changes of these universal awakenings. This is a place where you can connect in to assist you in your individual shifting as well as understand what is happening in the collective shifting. We have wonderful people in the chat room, which has been renamed as the Sacred Space of Empowerment by a couple of our listener participants. And you can freely ask questions in the chat simply by putting your question in caps, and then I will be able to see it, as well as you can call in with questions. The call-in number for questions is 347-539-5122. And you can also listen by phone. In fact, I had a couple emails this morning that people that would be are doing their errands are listening live. So they've emailed and said, I'm just listening today, and give them their number. So that's the wonderful gift that we have with technology, that we're able to listen by computer, by phone, listen while we're traveling. And you can take Awakenings with you wherever you go, because it is airing internationally since it's an online program. Whoa, wonderful day. First day of your life, right? Yes, it is. It's the first day of our life. As every day when we wake up, there is a chance for a new beginning, a new direction, and a new understanding, if we just open to that, if we simply look within or tune within and say, what's this day about? And then let it unfold. That's where I'm at right now, folks. That's where I'm at. One moment at a time, and one cell at a time, one shift at a time. Let's simplify here. Today we have with us an amazing, amazing aware, awake, enlightened being, and some of you will be familiar already with him, if not personally, definitely through his body of work. We have today Dr. Bruce Lipton, who is an internationally recognized authority in bridging science and spirit. You may know him from the book, The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter, and Miracles. The Biology of Belief is basically about learning how to harness your mind to promote growth in the secret of the life. And Dr. Bruce Lipton goes into this secret, which is really not a secret, but it's a secret until we find out what it is. And once we find out what it is very simple. And in aligning to this harnessing, that's where we begin to connect in to the creative aspect of ourselves to really unfold and live a life of infinite possibilities. So in the light of that infinite possibility, I would like to welcome Bruce to the program. Hi, Dr. Lipton.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for this wonderful opportunity in this very exciting time, of course.
Oh, yes. And I say infinite opportunity is because in reading your book, The Biology of the Belief, and as well as I want to talk to you also about the Spontaneous Evolution, the CD series that you did with Steve Behrman, which just for our listeners, by the way, the book will be out in September through Hay House. But that's what I came away with, is that, in essence, your study has shown that we're not limited by our genealogy. We're not limited by our biology. That there is a way to tap in, if you find that missing piece, there is a way to tap in to live our infinite possibilities.
Yes.
All right. That's
very
what I came
profoundly,
away
with. The answer is yes.
Yes. That's what I choked.
Well, for me, it's very exciting, this whole thing that's just unfolding right now. Because if I go back to my earliest start in my acquiring knowledge about the world as a youngster, I was given a lot of words of advice and wisdom from so-called spiritual people. And what was very interesting in my very young childhood observation of these people is that somehow or other their wonderful words never really matched their lives in any sense. And there was a point of, you know, hearing this kind of stuff and seeing the world, and it just didn't, the two didn't fit together. And then I started getting introduced into science, and science was so exciting because a truth in science is true on this side of the planet and the other side of the planet, and so basically a truth in science is a given as a truth in our world today. So I really gravitated away from spirituality, and in fact, I never really believed in it because by the time I got ingrained in the science enough, I was given an image and programmed with a biological image that we were more or less biochemical machines controlled by genes. And the relevance about this belief system, which is still propagated to the public, even though science doesn't say that anymore, but the public is still hearing it, the problem with this belief is that what it suggests is, the first thing is, as you mentioned, we're victims. We're victims because if genes control who we are, and then we realize, well, heck, we didn't pick the genes apparently that we came with, and we can't change the genes that we have, and we get born into a family with a lineage of some genetic thing, supposedly, such as cancer, Alzheimer's, diabetes, the list goes on and on, and then we see ourselves, oh my God, we were born into this machinery and victims of the machine, and it was like the heart attacks us. You know, we have heart attacks, or our cells are against us, our body is letting us down. And so we bought into that we live inside this fragile biochemical machine, and that we really have no control over it. And that and we buy that as a belief, of course, that we can't manipulate the genes. And so why has that become problematical? And the first thing is this. If you believe that, then the first thing you recognize is, yes, I'm a victim because I can't change these conditions. I was born into this family with these traits. Mm-hmm. Then you also then start to take on, unfortunately, an air of irresponsibility. And it's irresponsible only because first you were told you have no responsibility. So therefore, whatever you do and say, well, that's just the fate of my life, and I'll just go along and, you know, and express the fate of my life. So we become more or less irresponsible. By programming, not by decision, but by programming. And then we also, thirdly, we buy into the necessity of rescuers, people, organizations, entities that will make up for our frailty and our vulnerability, so that, you know, we have a pharmaceutical company out there pumping us with chemistry because obviously these stupid bodies can't figure it out, you know, they're discounting the fact that the human body has been taking care of itself a million years before there were medical schools. It basically
exactly.
Says,
what
does that mean? But we ignore that because what we are programmed with is the belief that we are really vulnerable to all kinds of things, viruses, bacteria, germs, and everything else. And so we're buying into, oh, my God, we got on this planet, and now the struggle is to survive. And, of course, that's also a belief as well because that comes from the notion of Darwinian theory, which is a belief that is shaping our civilization. Once they bought it as a scientific truth that we got here through this evolutionary process of competition, survival of the fittest, and so-called struggle for existence. Once science said that was a truth, then that truth permeated the fabric of our society. So my father, he didn't go to school, but he sure as heck knew Darwinian theory, not by the words of the scientific principles, but by what is the net result of Darwinian theory. Oh, we're living in a rat race, in a dog-eat-dog world, survival, competition. Why, if you don't compete, you're going to be trampled in this whole thing and all this stuff. So we buy into that. and I bought into it, and I was teaching it. So basically, it was like, yeah, it's a pretty grim picture when you start to look at it. And then I was fortunate enough to, while I was teaching these fundamentals in medical school, I was fortunate enough to be working on my experimental research, which involved cloning stem cells.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of people think stem cells are relatively new. That's, you know, something that just happened in the last couple of years. And no, truthfully, I was culturing and cloning stem cells back in 1967 and 68. So that's like 40 years ago. And the significance about this research, it was so profound. The results were so profound. And what I saw coming out of the experiments was so mind-boggling. There was a moment in my life where I realized I could no longer teach medical school. I couldn't do it because I was teaching according to the established curriculum, and that was the story about how genes control life. And what I found in my cell cultures back and published this research in the early 70s was this is absolutely not true. Genes don't control anything. It's our perception and our response to the environment, which makes a lot of sense because if you thought about it, we're just, you know, genetically programmed machines. Why would that be a problem? Because if the world that we live in, which is totally dynamic and changing from day to day, minute to minute, how can a pre-program of genes get you into a world that is keeping, you know, is keeping evolving?
Yeah,
all the
why
time?
Would only the gene? Now, Bruce, so how is there a percentage that is that you know, age or predisposition? Would you say there's some influence on a cellular level, on a genealogical level? Yeah.
Absolutely, but then here's a serious figure, and this figure, Michelle, is the fact that less than 5% of all illnesses on this planet really have an organic cause to them.
Less than 5%.
Yeah.
Okay.
All the other ones are essentially the consequence of stress and lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And why is that relevant? Is because, you know, it's very interesting is that we know that. Cardiovascular physicians are programmed with the knowledge that 90% or more of cardiovascular disease, totally lifestyle. And you say, well, then how come cardiovascular disease is one of the leading causes of life, you know, problems on this planet? And the answer is because even though we're aware that lifestyle causes this, they're not about to go out there and say, you know, instead of doing medications, drugs, instead of getting sick, science has now revealed that your lifestyle, this X, 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 and Y, is causing this heart disease that you have. And while they mention it, it's not really put up in the public so much. The public doesn't really hear this. And why is it relevant? Because if you're naive as to the cause of the disease, then you're going to continue getting the disease. And if you continue getting it, then we're going to be able to continuously sell you the drugs that are going to stop you from getting it. But they don't stop you from getting it. They you know, here's the interesting point. Medicine has drugs for cardiovascular patients. When they call a situation successful, what they're really referring to is the drugs have stopped the degeneration process, and it's, you know, right there, it stopped it. And that is called ultimate success. Interesting enough, Dean Ornish, a cardiovascular physician from San Francisco, did an experiment. He took a group of his patients, instead of giving them drugs, he said, I gave them new programs of life. I taught them better nutrition, and I taught them how to do meditations, and I taught them stress reduction techniques. Basically, he was changing the way they were responding to life. Mm-hmm. And the results were so amazing in that this was a consequence. They didn't take any drugs. But the interesting thing was not only did their cardiac degeneration actually stop, but they as a group reflected cardiac regeneration. They actually started to bring it back to health again. And medicine is, on the other hand, saying, hey, if we just stop the degeneration, we're successful. And here he shows, without any drugs, without, you know, any other techniques other than lifestyle, that these people cured themselves of this and regenerated their tissue. And medicine is no way able to do that. But now, why is this interesting? Because when I saw Dean Ornish, I saw him rightfully upset in a news conference, and he said, had I given the drug and got these very same results, every doctor in the world today would be prescribing this drug.
Right.
He said, but we didn't do it with drugs. And as a result, this information is not forthcoming from the medical community in lieu of them just selling the conventional drugs that they've been doing as standard procedure for all these numbers of years. And why is this relevant is because the institution has run away.
Yeah.
The health institution has gone on a wayward track, and it's immoral. It's basically immoral. And I'll let's just get to that point for a simple reason. And it's here's the immorality of the healthcare crisis. It's based on the healthcare system is based on corporate entities. Corporations, I don't care whether you're making widgets or doing surgery, the essence and function of the corporation is to make a profit for the shareholders. That's exactly what its function is. So basically, all of a sudden, what we have done is turned healthcare into a for-profit industry. Well, then the first thing you have to say, well, where the heck do you get the profit? The answer is you charge more than the services, you know, that you give. And then you also sustain the services for as long as you can. Because if you heal them, then what good is the business?
That's right.
And so basically, and here's the truth, because I have this from inside people from the pharmaceutical industry, that they do actually have some very, very effective medicines in their closet. Do they manufacture and release them? The answer is no. Simple reason, because the medicines they're selling now are not as effective, and as a result, are more sustainable as a product than to sell a drug that can actually stop the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not in an interest to do healing. And the system itself is not an interest to do healing. Why? Because the system itself knows that the causes of illness are stress and lifestyle. And they're not standing up saying, we could stop this health crisis right now if we got to the cause of the problem rather than dealing with the symptoms that are derived.
Well, they'd have to change the profit structure. They'd have to,
exactly.
The game would have to change, right?
And it is changing less and less people can afford the health care, and all of a sudden the business plan just went a little bit overboard. Why? Because you made it too expensive so the average person can't do it.
Right.
And now why is that a problem? Well, here's the interesting problem. You know what the exciting problem is? Is the more people that can't afford it, the healthier the people become.
That's right. You know, this reminds me, when you touched upon nutrition and the idea with the genes, years ago I was at some kind of health fair, and an amazing iridologist worked with a friend of mine, and so I got a session. And he says, oh, my God, you should be really sick. And he went on about how my constitution was and what I was born with, and then the family, he could see stressors, which was all true. And he said, how did you do this? And I said, I don't know. I said, I guess nutrition. I said, you know, I eat really healthy, and I'm, you know, very active, and I meditate and yoga. And he said, well, you completely changed your health pattern. What should have happened? Now that I'm talking to you, Bruce, I'm thinking, you know what, ignorance is bliss, because I had no clue that I had these predisposers.
you're absolutely right, Michelle. And it's not a joke in the sense, this is very serious, because when we understand the nature of how our consciousness shapes our biology, when your consciousness perceives that you have a problem and you own that problem,
wow,
then the function of consciousness is to manifest the problem. I want to make a statement, a short little phrase. And the significance about this, well, it's a very short little phrase. It's so profound that it really is.
Hello? I am not sure what happened here, but calling Dr. Lipton again.
Hello?
Dr. Lipton, I'm not sure
yes.
what happened. Yes, sir. And you were
Mercury
about to say
retrograde
that.
Or something.
You were about to say that phrase that was so profound, and I'm like...
And then, so that was a pregnant pause then.
It'd be a long pregnant pause, exactly.
Okay, and here's what the phrase is, and the phrase, as I said, was the function of the mind is to create coherence between our beliefs and our lives. And why that's relevant is it's our beliefs that actually generate our lives. This is not, like an outrageous woo-woo, oh my goodness, you know. It's actually quantum physics, and the quantum physicists have already established that the observer influences the reality, that the consciousness of the individual changes the experience of reality. And we've known that in the level of physics, But it is a concept that has been resisted to, in a sense, to influence the other fields of science. And yet, this is an unfortunate situation because science is a structured series of knowledges, one built on top of the other. And foundational is a science of physics. And the significance is if physics changes its belief system, every other science must change their belief system to accommodate that. And physics in 1925 said the observer creates the reality. But in 1925, the people were around like, what are you talking about? You know, in their world, they couldn't bring it into the world. So this is an interesting reality. The scientists of that very day said, we just can't bring this into our world. So what we'll do is arbitrarily restrict the concepts of quantum physics to only the level of atoms, that quantum principles only apply at the level of atoms. And they did that because it would have just made an upheaval in the whole civilization that you were consciously creating your life. Well, it's been, you know, 80-some years since that time, and the physicists today are saying, listen, the absolute physics and mechanics of this whole thing, it applies at every level of organization of the universe, and that quantum physics applies to not just atoms, it applies to people and society, the globe, and the universe itself. And why is that relevant? Because we must own the truth, and the truth is, the observer is creating this reality. But then you go into, well, who's the observer in this thing?
Yes.
And this is where the conflicts come from. And basically it says that we, through our mind, are taking our beliefs, the observer beliefs, and manifesting a reality that conforms to the beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
So if you bought a belief that you had cancer, you really bought it, no question, you will actually manifest cancer. And the significance is because we can manifest disease, but we also can manifest health. And so basically, to put us back into a picture that science has taken us out of years ago by saying, hey, you're just a biochemical machine, and you're actually run by genes. Just sit in the back seat of that vehicle and see where it goes. And the fact is, wait a minute, big mistake. We are actually the people with the hands on the wheel. But we've been given a driver education by other people that told us what we could do and what we couldn't do. And then when we believe that as a group, as a culture, because it comes from the top down, then the collective belief held as a culture actually becomes a physical manifestation of the world that we live in.
Mm.
And what kind of beliefs are we living in? Well, we're living in a scientific materialistic world. A scientific materialism means science, a scientific world, but it's based on the role of matter as being primary. So look at our world. How do you know if you're successful? How much matter do you own? You know, basically, it's what it comes down to. And why this becomes important is because this Newtonian view of the world is based on actions and reactions. It's based on the material world being primal and doesn't recognize the role of the invisible world. But in 1925, physicists said, wait a minute. What you're calling an atom, that thing that looks like marbles and ball bearings in a little miniature solar system, when those pictures that, of course, we saw in the book that gave us a program of visualization, yes, atoms are little physical things like this. Modern physics has looked inside that atom and said, you know, that was a nice illustration, but it has nothing to do with the truth. Because inside an atom is nothing in the sense of particles and electrons and protons and neutrons. They're actually only energy vortices, little nano tornadoes of energy. Well, why is that relevant? Well, atoms are made out of energy, and then atoms make cells. So cells are made out of energy, and cells make people. People are made out of energy. And we have to now get into the world of physics, the quantum world that says energy is the primary realm, and matter is the secondary realm. And there's a quote by Einstein, it's the ultimate in simplicity and the maximum in profundity. It goes like this. According to the quote, it goes, the field, and I'll just define the word field. Field is the invisible energy forces that bathe us. I mean, right around you, wherever you're sitting right now, there are television waves and broadcasts of microwave transmission, cell phone, radio.
Electromagnetic field.
The whole thing, the field.
Yeah.
Invisible, intangible. This mm-hmm. is the quote. The field is the sole governing agency of the particle. The particle means the physical material world. What did Einstein say? the invisible world is the sole shaping character, you know, providing factor for the material world. It's the invisible world that is primary. And it's interesting because this is exactly the same definition that spiritualists use, using other vocabulary words, but saying the same thing: invisible moving forces, spirit, or now physics, the field. Invisible moving forces are shaping the physical mechanical world. Well, the invisible moving forces that are primal for each one of us are the invisible forces called the mind. Mm-hmm. Our mind is like a broadcast antenna, broadcasting fields, invisible forces that end up causing the physical world around us to be influenced by our thoughts and help shape the world that we perceive. So when the physicists say the observer creates the reality, and when the biology or the new age person comes up and says your mind is shaping your life, it's exactly the same statement.
Same thing. Yeah, it's just a different words. Now, we have a question in the chat, Bruce, if you can touch upon the emerging fifth tier, which is psychology.
Somebody saw that tier somewhere, didn't they?
Yes, Steve. We're all a family here. Someone's come from a second helping. You've been on another program, and they said they're back. They can't get enough. So.
Well, I think if we're talking about this is that when we talk about the structure of science, as I said, that it's built on blocks of knowledge where foundational blocks provide a support for the next level of science, which then builds a story that then supports the next level of science. So if I have it right, then are we still on the air?
Yes.
Okay, you know, I'm getting concerned now with the last click that I thought.
Oh, I know. I don't know what happened, but you were talking, and then all of a sudden there was nothing, and then I don't
Yeah,
know.
So we're still here, though. The point about it is the scientists are, if this is the tier we're talking about, the scientists are in a hierarchy. And the most fundamental science that exists in the world is the science of mathematics. And mathematics is not even a tangible thing. It's a mental relationship. There's no physical character to mathematics, but you needed to understand mathematics to create science. And so, for example, physics was derived first from mathematics. And so, in other words, Isaac Newton just didn't look up at the planets and then discover, you know, the mechanism of planetary movement and predicting planetary movement. He first had to develop mathematics. He created the science of differential calculus. Using then the math, he was then able to create an understanding of the mechanisms of the universe. So math was preceding of physics. Physics means mechanics. Physics is like quantum physics, quantum mechanics, or Newtonian physics, Newtonian mechanics. Physics means mechanisms. So the fundamental mechanisms of the universe are described in a science called physics. Why does anything happen? But then once you understand that, then you start to look at the influence of these mechanics on the material world, and that's chemistry. So then you start looking at the nature of the physical pieces that make up our presumably physical world. And then there's all different kinds of chemistry, and ultimately you get to what's called biochemistry, organic chemistry. And that is the predecessor of what is called biology, because the biochemistry created the biology. Then you build the knowledge base of biology based on first the math, then the physics, then the chemistry, then you build biology. And once you have an understanding of the insights of nature of biology, and especially the nervous system, then we build the next level, which is called psychology. Psychology is predicated on the principles of biology, which are predicated on chemistry, et cetera, down. Mm-hmm. And now what's interesting about it is the new science is revealing an additional component to our psychology, one that wasn't previously conceived of in the physical mechanical world, because it isn't physical and mechanical, that our psychology is not just the chemistry of our body, which is conventional, the pursuit of conventional medicine's understanding of psychology. Psychology, that's just the chemistry of the body, and your chemistry is not right, so take these drugs, we'll fix your psychology, you're a chemical machine. The new physics brings in an important reality that psychology is influenced by the field. Well, that's what Einstein said. The field is shaping the matter. We're now finding the influence of the field that individually influences each one of us is something that is tantamount to a part of the invisible field, the energy matrix, that in the olden days was called spirit.
Yeah.
We can still call it.
we're yeah. going back to
and,
that,
and,
right?
And this was a big wake-up call, because as I started out, remember, I said, I didn't believe in the spiritual stuff. I went into science. Mm-hmm. But when I finally understood the nature of how the cell worked, and this is, let's say this phrase because it should or hopefully come back later in the discussion. What changed my entire life was on a particular moment in 1985, and as I said, like up to like about 1:59 in the morning, I was one of your really devout non-spiritual people. I was working on the molecular nature of how cells work in biology. And what I had found at that time, based on my stem cell culture research, was that the cell wasn't controlled by the genes. There was the brain, but it wasn't the genes. The brain was the equivalent of the membrane of the cell, the skin. And the significance about it was that when I understood the molecular mechanism of the skin, I wrote a definition down. And this is, let's say, like at 1:59 in the morning, I'm writing this down, and I say that the cell membrane, and this is an accurate biochemical description, the cell membrane is a liquid crystal semiconductor with gates and channels. Mm. And I paused for a moment because I said, geez, that's a very familiar-sounding definition. Where did I read that? And there in front of me was my first Macintosh, and next to it a book from Radio Shack, a simpleton book of how computers work. It was called Understanding Your Microprocessor. So I quickly picked up the book, and there it was, right in the introduction. The definition of a computer chip is a crystal semiconductor with gates and channels. And I stopped for a second and said, wow, what a coincidence. They actually have the same definition. You know, this is all occurring in like milliseconds, right? So between 1:59 and 2 a.m., this is like a downloading machine is just putting data in, going, wow, what a coincidence.
You're being led. Did you see this? You're being led.
and the biggest thing that hit me at the first moment was really recognizing it was not a coincidence. This is what my research on the cells revealed. Every cell is a programmable chip. Every cell can become anything the program says. And what kind of programs? Well, in the human body, every cell, the program is called the nucleus with the genes. Well, I said, what can you make with the genes? And I say, a whole human being. You can make any part of a human being. So every cell has the program to become anything, including a whole human being. And what I found out was that the genes didn't control what the outcome was. It was the environmental information, what was going on in the world. So the biological system was adjusting its own biology to meet the demands and needs of the environment. And so basically life was this interesting balance where a living organism must continuously adapt and adjust itself to fit the dynamic world that we live in. And that's why the gene programs aren't fixed. They have to be changeable. Mm-hmm. And so, but there I was at that 1:59, somewhere now closer to 2 o'clock in the morning, and all of a sudden I said, oh, my God, the cell membrane is like the keyboard processor, and the nucleus is a hard drive. And it turns out, while I was teaching in medical school, the nucleus was a read-only hard drive, meaning whatever programs you got, that's what you are. I recognize now that the nucleus is a read-write disk, meaning you came with genetic programs, but you have the ability to modify each of the genes in your body. And here's a realistic scientific number that is mind-blowing. Every gene in your body can be modified by you through your lifestyle to create, listen to this, 30,000 different variations from the same gene blueprint, meaning you can rewrite everything at any time. And
so what's the piece to rewriting that? So we know this. We come in with a biological or genealogical, and if we're even going to look, you know, spiritually or shamanically, you have that ancestral realm from those that have gone before you. But you're saying we have the ability to rewrite it.
The basic is go back to the nature of the computer, and this is what I saw. As I was sitting in the front of the computer while I was typing this data, as the awareness was hitting me, I realized I'm not in the computer, I'm outside the computer. Mm-hmm. But the computer is taking my data and turning it into the image on the screen. And all of a sudden I realized, oh my God, the cell is not controlled from within. It's controlled by the situations on the outside, which includes our spirit. And that's what woke me up, because by 2 o'clock in the morning, I said, the programmer's not inside the machine. And then it's like, oh. So basically, I in that minute, I transitioned from like totally not spiritual in the mechanical world to owning as a scientific reality that it wasn't questionable. It wasn't questioned. It was like, oh my God, whoever's typing on the cellular membrane, the keyboard on the outside is the programmer, and the programmer's not on the inside. And I recognize that each one of us has on the set of our cells a bunch of little antennas. They're almost like little television antennas, but they're keyed to different vibrational frequencies. So they're like a combination lock in a sense that each one of us has on the surface of ourselves these little antennas tuned to different frequencies, so we're each receiving the equivalent of a different radio broadcast.
Mm.
And the relevance is our identity is not on the inside. We are the energy and the information of the invisible field, and that we get a chance to play through the body through these antennas. Well, what hit me the first thing, of course, as well, my identity is part of the outside, which is that we're all part of the same, so that's the connection to all of the unity. But what I realized at that very important moment in my life, and this is critical because all of us are born with the innate fear of our mortality. And, of course, me too. And there, but at this one moment, I thought, and I said, oh, my God. The body's like a little television receiver. Our lives are the image on the screen, but the broadcast comes from the invisible realm. And the why that was relevant was I just stopped there for a little moment of logic and said, you know, if you're watching a TV and the picture tube breaks, you say, hey, the TV's dead. And the fact, yeah, the TV is dead. But the question is, when the picture tube broke, did that stop the broadcast? And the answer is, no, the broadcast's there whether the television's receiving it or not. And all of a sudden I said, oh my God, if the body dies, the identity broadcast that's coming through these antennas on our own individual cells, the broadcast is still there.
Broadcast.
And that was this, oh my God, in 1 minute going from a physical, mechanical presence of the universe and turning around and going, oh my God, is this a spiritual, immortal, eternal thing? Oh, that certainly, you know, changed my perspective of life at that very instant.
That's a huge awakening, Bruce. That's huge. Well, it's directional. You redirected your whole life from that situation.
You know, it's the hardest thing to explain because there was a weight there that we carry, and we don't know we carry the weight because it's always there until the moment it's gone.
Interesting.
And the weight was gone at that moment. It was the weight of the fear of mortality. It was a weight that all of us have because it's built into biological organisms. Every organism will avoid death in every way possible, even a bacteria. So it's built into our biology about this thing about death. And yet at that very moment when I owned it as a scientific reality that my identity was not inside the system, then this weight just lifted off the fear, the protection that we all carry around with us unconsciously. It's not that we walk around with this on our sleeve saying, see, I'm protecting myself here. It's just always there. And it was the greatest joy and relief of my life because it was like, the fear is gone. The fear is gone. That's the most amazing thing in the whole world to actually say, you know, because it was gone. Why? My broadcast is me. I'm not the television set. And that was a scientific principle of understanding the nature of how quantum mechanical energy fields influence the shaping of the cells. But then you go back and you say the most important question that you started with, and I didn't let you get there.
you just added more. You expanded.
But the question was, what about changing it? And all of a sudden it's like, yes. And the first thing to recognize who you are and the relationship of you to your body and the relationship of you to your mind, because since the mind is the interface that reads and interprets the environment and then adjusts the biology so that the organism can survive and maintain itself in that environment. So you watch and read the environment for all these cues so that you can create the right behavior to stay alive. That's basically what the mind's function is. So the mind's function is to observe that environment and then call up the behaviors that we have been programmed with to survive in that environment. And so basically the mind controls not just the behavior, but the mind controls our genetic regulation. So if you believe you have a disease and the mind is convinced of that, then you will actually physically manifest the disease. You know, in a sense that how many years we've been looking for cancer genes? Well, there are not really, per se, any cancer genes, meaning this. There's no gene right now that says this gene causes cancer. That cancer is actually the result of the interaction of a minimum of 12 to 15 genes and most times up to 200 different genes. And why that's relevant is, our old story was, oh, yeah, cancer is because a cell mutated. Like it just has a random accidental event, and then it mutated. It says, no, you have to say now, oh, a cell randomly 14 times mutated exactly the right thing to create a cancer. It's like, okay, that doesn't sound the same. All of a sudden, it's like,
that's right.
It wasn't an accident of an individual event. Cancer is a culmination of a whole series of inputs to the system, and that we now recognize that almost all cancers are not genetic in origin, but they're basically called epigenetic in origin, and that's the new science of how the mind interfaces the genes, meaning as you change your mind and your perceptions, you change your genetic readout. Interesting, a simple reality. When identical twins are born, genetically identical twins, if you do a gene readout of the genes that are active in both of these siblings, you'll find that essentially they're pretty closely reading the same genes. But then what they did is a study, and they wanted to do the gene readout after 6 months, a year, 5 years, 10 years, and so on. And what blew them away was that every day of life, the two individual siblings, they had different experiences, resulted in their genetic readouts diverging to the extent they were completely unrelated in a certain degree after years of their experience. And why that's relevant is, it's a little different story than the one that we told people, your genes are your fate and that's hardwired. Now it says, well, you change your genes just by every day of living, but you didn't know it. But what if you did know it? What if you knew that you were doing this, and if you knew the mechanism of doing it? Then all of a sudden, the world switches from the belief that we're all victims inside these biochemically, genetically controlled robotic bodies and switches around and says, you are the master, you are programming this body, and you're programming not just what's going on inside, but you're also programming what's going on outside. And all of a sudden you start to realize when this hits you as a reality and not as, that's a nice idea, but I mean a reality, then all of a sudden you have the opportunity to go from the former victim that we talked about to the current master, the creator of your life and the conditions that surround it.
And that's why I say, I mean, reading your book, it's to me, it is about connecting to those infinite possibilities, because once you know this, you're not determined. You're not in a determined universe. You're interacting, you're responding, to the dance, you recognizing that you are that broadcasting frequency as well as the broadcast. You're both, and you are able to influence, which before, you know, the permeating thought was, and you even said it medically, that we didn't have influence. There was these things being done to us, or these cells were doing this to us, or because of our right
brain. Everything else, because since we denied our connection to the machine, then we denied the consequence of what happened to the machine. If the heart broke down, it's because the heart broke down. Let's blame the damn heart, you know. Let's blame the cells. Let's blame the fat cells because we're fat, or whatever these things are. And this is a legitimate, excuse in a world that has already programmed you with the belief that you're a victim of the machine. And then what you've done, though, in being a victim of the machine, you have given up your opportunity to control the machine, because you've given it up to somebody you said that is the master of the machine. So we have been programmed, essentially almost all of us, I mean, there are always large numbers of exceptions, but most of us have been programmed with this belief. Think about it. We were born with doctors present. We go to doctors as infants on periodic checkups all the time, but most importantly, what we recognize in our experiences of growing up in a family is that whether we're sick or somebody else in the family becomes sick, there is a behavior that's put into play and it says, oh, Johnny's sick, we must take Johnny to the doctor. And what the learning that is produced by these experiences that are repeated over and over again, the subconscious learning is that when it comes to matters of healing yourself, you first have to go to the doctor, because the doctor is the professional. And so what have you done? You've given up your own ability to heal yourself by a belief that says, I don't heal myself, the doctor heals me. And here's the joke. You know, the funny joke is the numbers of people that get well on the way to the doctor or sitting in the doctor's office. And why is that relevant? And the answer was, and here's the underlying and fundamental reason. As I mentioned earlier, look, humans have been alive and healthy for millions of years before medical schools existed. And that is because the innate system of the body was designed to heal itself. Otherwise, we all would have died out a long time ago. And the fact is, no, innately, we're all capable of healing yourself. You can replace any tissue or component of your body if it gets damaged. And the significance about that is that we have that as an innate built-in mechanism. It's called an instinct. And yet, because our mind does the programming, our program can override an instinct.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, you were built in with the ability to heal yourself, but your program says, I don't heal myself, I go to the professional. Well, and the fun part, that's where the jokey part came in, is sort of like, it never said we're going to go to the doctor and do X, Y, and Z, it's just we're going to go to the doctor. So it didn't say the doctor had to do anything. All you had to do was show up at the doctor, and then it opened up the floodgate of the ability to innately hear yourself. And so it's really almost all healing comes from our own mind. In fact, medicine acknowledges grudgingly that a minimum of one-third of all healings, including surgery, are directly the result of the placebo effect, which is basically saying what? The mind did it. And that's a minimum of one-third, and probably a lot more. And yet the problem is, while the mind is, of course, the source of healing and the placebo effect, we are not acknowledging to the public the value of what is called the nocebo effect. The nocebo effect is the same as the placebo effect, in a sense, the mind influencing health. But while the placebo effect is a positive mind influencing a healing process, a nocebo effect is a negative mind causing a disease or death. And now we also know this to be, you know, very, very profoundly true. Our beliefs, if they're positive, can heal us, and our beliefs, if they're negative, can kill us. And this is a scientific fact. And yet, so how come we don't talk about that when you go to the doctor's office? And the answer is, it's always been the part of the system to take the mind out of the equation. And then you're left with a dumb machine.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a dumb machine as a body, then you need an intelligent repairman to throw into chemistry. And yet, nobody asked the mind to come back in there. And yet, you go look at the history of our world and the thing called healings and healers and people who have put hands on other people, and then these profound healings come about. And we don't want to talk about that in the medical world because there is no biochemical pathway to describe that. So we ignore it. And it's like, how much of this ignoring must we do? How much of the fact that at least one-third of all healing just had to do with the person's mind? And how much about all the other things such as spontaneous remission and miraculous healings and all this must we keep ignoring because they are exceptions to the science as known by conventional allopathic medicine? The answer is, well, for a while they got away with it, but even today people are beginning to recognize, you know, there are other ways to heal yourself besides taking drugs and chemistry, and we're moving away from that model. And yet what people really have a hard time getting into, because we've been programmed to be disempowered. We've been programmed
we've been programmed that the spiritual aspect, the idea of the psyche or the soul or the intangible, has been perhaps superstitious, and that the idea of science or medicine as cut it, open it, fix it, put it back together, this predeterminism has been touted as the higher evolution. And do you see there's a pendulum that seems to be swinging back, embracing the other?
Well, you know, that higher evolution is totally questionable for a simple reality.
Yeah.
Medicine itself as an organization acknowledges that they are the third leading cause of death in the United States. And that's a conservative estimate because other statistics suggest that actually it is the first leading cause of death in the United States, a consequence of what they call iatrogenic illness, which basically in Latin says the result of medical treatment. meaning I go to the doctor with problem A, get treated, but die from problem B, the consequence of the treatment.
Yeah.
So it turns out that iatrogenic illness is one of the leading causes of death in the United States. Now you have to just stop, and anybody with a logic brain in their head will have to say, wait a minute, wait. The health industry is either the third or the first leading cause of death. Let me see, is that logically compute? The answer is, what? What are you talking about? And I'm not going to knock medicine and say disappear for this very important reason, because medicine does absolute miracles with what it knows best, and that is the body as a physical vehicle. And why is that important? Because if I'm in a car accident and I get myself cut open and my viscera is hanging out all over the place, you know, a chiropractor or a massage therapist or homeopathy practitioner is not exactly who I'm going to look for, you know? And basically say, yeah, what does medicine do? I say, well, they do miracles. Yes, they can transplant a heart. They can sew you up. They can set the bones. They can do all these things. They really do miracles. But then let's talk about another thing. If it isn't trauma, how well does the medical profession score? So I say, well, give me an example. What's not trauma? Cancer, Alzheimer's, diabetes, arthritis, multiple sclerosis. Let's go on and on.
Yeah.
These aren't trauma. These are functional defects. So the question is, how do they fare at functional defects? And the answer is not very good.
Not very good at all.
And then not very good at all. And the reason is why. They don't know the element of the function, but they do know the ability to cut the parts out and put them back in again. It's sort of like the auto industry today. In the old days, you know, an auto repair person could lift up the hood of your car just listening to it. Could say, oh, yeah, I can fix this and start to adjust into the fixing. Today you open up and there's this computer, first of all, and it's not working. What do you do? Well, take the whole damn computer out and put a whole new computer in. It's like, can't you fix the computer? It's like, nah, just replace it. It's easier. You got a bad heart? How can I fix it? Oh, don't fix it. Just replace it. It's easier. And so we have taken that approach. So while medicine can handle the parts, it fails at understanding the nature of how the parts actually work. And that's where the failure comes from.
Now, Bruce, would you say, let's say, because there's a new paradigm that's already here, but let's see, being co-created on a more mainstream level as this information gets more out there, do you see that a new medicine, if you will, or a new paradigm of medicine will be embracing more of the psyche, the spiritual,
it has
the
to,
power of the mind?
Because it's already the given, the knowingness of this, the letting go of the material realm and then actually honoring the invisible realm's role and influence in our lives is happening at the very front edge of science today. And yet, here's the problem. When I'm talking about a lot of this stuff, scientists would acknowledge a lot of it. I mean, some of them can't go that far because they're programmed in the system to get the grants, and you get the grants by appealing to the existing story. That's how you get a grant. But the reality is this. The gap is actually not the gap of knowledge. It's the gap between the scientists who have the knowledge and the public that gets a different story. The public is still being bathed with stories of their victimization. They're still being bathed with their frailty. Watch out for the viruses. Here they come, you know, and get ready for this, you know. They're still being given a story that is so outdated by scientists that if you told them that, they'd look in shock, like the story that genes are controlling these functions. That is a reality that scientists have already acknowledged. Genes don't control anything, and yet, read the paper. Well, you've got a gene and it controls this, and this is a cancer gene, and, you know, and you've got this breast cancer gene. It's like, well, what did you do? The first thing is you told the person, A, they have the gene, and the gene does this, and B, what is their program? Their program is the doctor is the professional who has the truth about things, and you don't. So whatever the doctor's truth is, it becomes your truth, your program, and the significance of your mind is to take that truth and then manifest reality, and then you see why, how a doctor can so easily say that a person's going to die in, like, 6 weeks, 3 months, whatever it is, and the patient dies pretty much close to that date. As if, well, did the doctor predict it in the sense that this is really true, or did the doctor set the date and the person adjusted their biology?
That's right. Well, that suggestion
absolutely
is so powerful. Now, Bruce, we touched on a little bit about the programming, the unconscious programming, and before we went live on air, we talked about this is the missing piece, and we were talking about how
yes.
if people would become the more aware of this, that, and essentially it is, if you can read all the books or, you know, the CDs or put all the affirmations, all the posties up, however you want to, but if that programming, that unconscious or subconscious programming isn't changed, you know.
There you are.
Yeah, like before. Yes.
And it's true. I'll give you a personal story because before I was aware of this, I had consciously become aware of the mechanisms of the cell membrane and the information processing and the readout of the genes and all this stuff back in the early 80s. I was already, in fact, I gave my first lecture on this stuff, I think, in 1983 or something. And what was interesting in the early days is if I could get people to stop long enough to listen to me, I'd say, listen, you see this new science right here. What does this mean? It's if you fully understand what I'm talking about, you can create this most fabulous life. And while I was giving this kind of presentation, I noticed that the audience ultimately was looking at me and cocking their heads and going, hey, listen, for a guy who says you know this stuff, your life doesn't look that great. And I found myself almost in a situation saying, oh, do as I say, not as I do. And that was the wake-up call. The wake-up call is very clearly this. There are two minds which we really must get into, the conscious mind and the subconscious mind. There are two fundamentally different ways of learning. The conscious mind learns in a completely different way than the subconscious mind. The subconscious mind is a habit-recording mind. It records experiences that are repeated, so that if it's repeated, then it's already prepared to see that experience that ever shows up again. So habits are in the subconscious mind. Knowledge can be in the conscious mind, but the two don't necessarily cross over. As I was demonstrating, hey, here's this wonderful conscious knowledge of how biology works, and don't look at my behavior because that information hasn't crossed into the program. And that's because at that time, not very much awareness that I have about this other part of it because I was still at the cellular level. Now the story comes full circle, and as I said, that profound statement, the mind, the function of the mind is to create coherence between the beliefs and the reality. Then I say, well, what is this mind? Then I say, well, there's two parts, conscious and subconscious. Now here's the critical part. The conscious mind is the smaller piece of the brain, relatively small because think of it, it was added on after the brain already formed. Organisms up through humans have brains, but the higher organisms, not just humans, things like dolphins and porpoises and elephants and chimps and things like this, also have a conscious part that evolved. So it evolved from the brain. So it's smaller than the brain as a functional piece. But here's the point. The conscious mind is the mind that is connected with our personal identity. It's the mind that is connected to our source, our spirit, whatever you want to say. This is your personal mind. The function of the conscious mind is creativity. So the first creative thing that you'll answer is, when I ask the question is, what do you want from your life? After that, that's a creation. I would like, oh, I want to be healthy. I want to have a great romance. I want to have...
Well, that's a great way to put it, that it's creative.
That's what its function is.
Yeah.
It's not a program. It's the one that could put all the pieces together and come out with an image that is satisfying to you. Mm-hmm. So the conscious mind is totally creative. The subconscious mind is a database of instincts and previously learned experiences. Mm-hmm. And so why is this relevant? Because the two minds are not equal in their function. One is created, the other is habitual. That the subconscious mind, and this is very critical as well, doesn't live in the future or in the past. The subconscious mind is a program of the present moment. It doesn't say, like when you were a kid and you were told, you don't deserve that. It didn't say, oh, yeah, I only don't deserve things while I'm this little kid because when I grow up, I will deserve things. No, the subconscious mind records, I don't deserve. That's what it records.
And
I don't deserve.
It imprints.
And imprints that. So why is it relevant? Because let's say I record, you're 5 years old, and you just heard this from your parent, and I have a tape recorder there, and it says, you don't deserve that. And now I come back 35 years later, and I say, what does the subconscious have to say about deservability? And you push the button, and it says, you don't deserve that. It's the same tape.
In the same tone, too.
Exactly, because you hear it in your own head over again as well. But why is this relevant? It's because the subconscious doesn't think into the future, think into the past. Whatever programs it learned, it's only learned them to use at a present moment. It learns how to drive a car. It doesn't learn how to drive a car in the future. It learns how to drive a car right now. And so when you want to drive a car, it's right now. And why is this then relevant is that the conscious mind is the one that can think into the future and think into the past and then solve problems. So the conscious mind is a wandering mind. It flips from this idea to that idea and this idea. It's flipping all over creatively, you know, doing these wonderful things in most cases, or actually in many cases, maybe not, creative visualizations and stuff like that. But here's the problem. When the conscious mind is flipping through these things from one to the other, it's not paying attention to the current moment. And when it's not paying attention to the current moment, then any function that you're doing, from walking and breathing to talking, driving a car, doing your job, if they're habits because you've done them before, then the subconscious mind will take over the habit and play it for you and allow your conscious mind the luxury of wandering. Well, here's the problem. Neuroscientists now have found that because our mind flips so frequently, that at most, and this is the killer, at most, the conscious mind runs our lives about 5% of the time, and on average about 1% of the time. And you say, what does that mean? I just say, here's the bottom line. Your conscious mind is a creative mind with your wishes, desires, aspirations, what you want from life. That mind operates and controls your biology from 1% to 5% of the time. That means from 95 to 99% of your life is actually a play out of habituated programs that are in your subconscious mind. And some of these programs are good. The innate ability to heal yourself is really good to have that in there. Why? You don't have to do any healing. You just let the subconscious mind do the healing. It'll do it for you. And yet we can override these instincts, which unfortunately did with our medical education, and said, you don't heal yourself. So that's the first program that then overrides the ability to heal yourself until you get the approval of a doctor. Then you heal yourself. So the relevance is this. What you want in your life comes from your conscious mind, plays less than 5% of the time. You are actually, your life is a printout of the programs in your subconscious mind. Now, this has a very interesting consequence of recognizing your subconscious mind is present moment all the time. It behaves like a precocious 5-year-old, and I hope I remember that in a moment, because that is very important about reprogramming the mind. But the subconscious mind is the equivalent of a jukebox. You push the button, it plays the program, and it will always, every time you push it, it's still going to play the same tape over and over and over again. In fact, it's amusing because a lot of people say, that guy pushed my buttons. And yes. What that meant was, oh, all these behaviors started playing, yeah. And I was,
you were triggered. Now, Bruce, yeah, I have a couple of questions, and I wrote down, we go to the back to the precocious subconscious mind, but
yes.
We'll get back to that. But now, the subconscious mind, we've got a question from Debbie. Does our spirit override ever to self-heal?
Yes, it can.
It can.
But the issue is, can you maintain consciousness more than 1% to 5% of the time in controlling mm-hmm. your life?
Okay.
And that's
more than how
that's
much?
The default. What's that?
More than how much now? So it can
override. I'm saying that we know now the number is your conscious mind, which is your spiritual connection.
Right.
Runs the show on an average daily basis today, most about 1% and up to 5% of the time. So
more
you want
meditation.
To heal yourself? What's that?
More meditation then.
Well, it's basically more mindfulness.
Mindfulness,
Buddhist
yeah.
mindfulness. And so the issue is, if you could run your life with your conscious mind, then would it not match your vision of what you thought was what you wanted from life? I mean, in other words, if you were fully running your life from your conscious mind and not relying on the programs in the subconscious mind, what would your life look like? And then here's what I'm going to make a suggestion. I'm going to make a suggestion that people on this line have already done that. And I will make a suggestion that when they did run their life with their conscious mind, that if I ask them to go back to this time, which I'll indicate in a minute, I say, go back to this time, and I say, tell me if you were healthy. Tell me how much energy you had. And I'm going to say, you were the healthiest you were. You had more energy than you could ever imagine. I say, tell me how life was unfolding at that time. You say, it was heaven on earth. And then I'm going to tell you something. We all have created moments of heaven on earth. And the most common time of that creation is what I call the honeymoon period, when you've just met this new individual in your life and you see that this person is the individual that you've always wanted to be there, your life partner, soul partner, whatever the thing you want to call it, and you see this person, when you first meet and you realize this could be it, the explosion, the heart blowing out, the whole thing, you know, it's head over heels in love, is that moment, for the next little period of time, you are actually not relying on the subconscious programs, but you actually start running your life with your consciousness. And what I'm saying is go back to that time and then recognize how wonderful life was, how healthy you were, how much energy you had, how everything was just going that beautifully. Unfortunately, and then I'd have to say, yeah, but the honeymoon period for most people wanes, and for some people very quickly, and for others can sustain it for a lot longer. And the question is, well, what does it represent? And the honeymoon period is a period of conscious creation. And I'll give you an example. I say we run our lives 95% of the time from the subconscious program. So let's say the day before you meet this special person, I say, tell me about that particular day. I say, well, how long did it take you to get dressed that day? He said, well, you know, about 10 minutes I was dressing out of the house. I say, well, how about when you ate lunch that day? He says, well, you know, I got that burger down and scarfed it down, wiped my face with my sleeve, and I was out of there in 5 or 8 minutes or something like that. And then I say, okay, now the next day, you've met this person, and you're going to go on your first date. And then I say, how long is it going to take you to get dressed today? 10 minutes is obviously not the answer. And it could take hour, 2 hours to get dressed, okay? And I say, okay, and when you went to dinner, how about that? And you say, man, every rule of etiquette that ever came into my entire history was playing that night. I knew what every one of those pieces of silverware on the table was to be used for. I started talking without chewing food in my mouth and talking at the same time. I actually blotted my mouth with a napkin instead of my sleeve. And guess what? I was actually deliberating on the words that I was actually going to say,
so
and I
like
did.
Conscious creation, conscious.
You were consciously.
Yeah.
Yeah. What you were doing was, instead of relying on a habit, which is just automatic, you wanted to be sure that you were presenting yourself in your best configuration, mm-hmm. that this person is going to be looking at you, and they're going to be judging whether this, you are the one that they want. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean? Well, then you're going to sure as hell make sure that you're going to present yourself in every way possible that they would want what you have. And so what does that mean? No longer is this tape going to play. When I'm getting dressed, I'm looking in that mirror for 2 hours until I get every piece right. And when I get on that, when I'm talking at the table, I'm going to be witty and chatty and so wonderful and beautiful and all that because I'm going to damn well think about what I'm going to say. And this is called the honeymoon period. Why? Because you're actually then using your conscious mind to create a life that you hold in your conscious mind. And all of a sudden it's manifesting. And you're head over heels in love. And the world is beautiful. It's like, that wasn't an accident. That wasn't just because that week happened to be the stars lined up and all of a sudden it was your moment and that was it. It happened because you took active control and did not rely on the tapes. And all of a sudden your life matched what you had in your mind. And then here's the failure. Why doesn't it match it when the subconscious is in charge? And I said, your conscious mind has your wishes and your desires, your aspirations. The subconscious mind has programs. And now listen to this. The fundamental programs in the subconscious mind were downloaded by observing others. And this occurs in the first 5 years of your life. And the brain is designed to do this for a very important reason. You cannot be conscious the moment you're born for this reason. If, let's say somebody, a baby could be totally conscious the moment it was born, and the baby's just coming out of the birth canal, and you were just standing over that baby and say, tell me something. And the baby would look up and say, I don't know what to say. I just got here, and I don't have any idea about anything that's going on, so I have nothing to say. And basically meaning, you can't be conscious if you don't have anything, any data. It's sort of like if you get a new iPod out of the box and you push play, nothing plays. Why? There's no program to select from. Ah, you have to program it.
Yeah.
So nature designed the brain for the first 5 years of a child's life to be in brain EEG waves, the predominant waves of theta. And theta waves are very low frequencies, but they're also the waves of hypnosis. So that a child's first 5 years, it's in a hypnotic trance. And what does it mean? It's like a recording device. It's like a video recorder. It's recording everything it sees and it hears. Why? Because those are the fundamental programs of life, because it has to start engaging in a culture and it needs the rules. Well, if consciousness was in there, it would get in the way, because if an infant could have consciousness, says, why should I do that? It's like, no, no,
and also,
no asking why.
Yeah, isn't it, one thing I think too about programming is that for those years, whether womb to five or womb to eight, it's those, that programming suits that environment to some degree for pro-survival. And I find where people get the hiccups come is they keep the same programming that suited them so long ago, because as you said earlier in our talk here, that we live in this universe that is, you know, morphing and changing and is very adaptable, but yet people carry that same programming all the way through and it no longer fits or no longer serves their new environment or environments.
So this is exactly the same definition for whether it's an individual or whether it's civilization, and that's why civilization is crashing at this moment, because the rigid beliefs of this is the way life works turn mm-hmm. out not to be real, and because we've been following these misperceptions, the unreality of those misperceptions have altered our own world to the extent that it's not providing for our survival, which means we better start adapting to a new way. Whether that's a whole civilization or an individual in a civilization, it's all exactly the same. And yet, we also have to tell you this, that many of the programs that you got downloaded with were not even your parents' program. They came from their parents or their parents. And so we have been programmed by dead people. and the issue is we carry their anger and their irritations and their troubles from generation to generation. That's why, for example, the concept of peace in the Middle East is very difficult. Why? Because they've been fighting each other so long that every baby is born and programmed with the fight even before they're conscious, and that's why they continue the process. So we get a lot of very bad programming, and the most important bad programming has to deal with our empowerment. And it goes like this. When you understand the nature of the biology, you will actually realize that every human being is equally powerful in creativity, creating the world that they live in. And then you say, come on, Bruce, look at this world. How can everybody be equal? Look, there are people that live on a dollar a week and barely is alive. And there are people like, well, there are Bill Gates with $60 billion in his pocket. What are you talking about equality here? The question is, and how did people like Bill Gates or all those people with that money and that higher prestige, and where did they get the extra power from? Joke, you ready?
Yeah,
they didn't get extra power. They don't have any more power than you do. What did they do to get more powerful? Is that the powerful people took away a power from us, so we can't express our power. We're as powerful as any one of those, but we don't express our power. Why? Because we've been programmed to not be powerful. And it's interesting because, especially in New Zealand and Australia, where I spend a lot of time, they talk about a concept called cutting the tall poppies. And it's a truism about child raising. And it says when a gardener plants poppies, you get a whole row of poppies. All the poppies come up and stand about the same height. But every now and then, a poppy will stick its head up a foot or two above all the other ones. And what does the gardener do to make the garden pretty? Cut the heads off the tall poppies. And what that really means in child raising is when a child shows traits that go beyond the average, then the job of the gardener, parent in this case, is to bring that child back down to the average.
Or teachers. I saw that in teaching. I used to teach, and it was problematic if you in the regular school system, if you had students that were excelling, because where do we put them? What do? We don't have the program. Now, Bruce, we do have one question that goes along the lines with what we're speaking of right now. How do you get the subconscious mind involved in the positive thinking? So if that...
Okay, that's a good one, because here's the issue. How does that mind learn? That's what we have to recognize, and here's the failure of the system. What have we done traditionally? Well, you educate your conscious mind with, this is the reason why that... You go to the psychiatrist, right? You relive all these painful experiences. Your dad did this, your mom did that, your friend did this, whatever. And you go through these and you live through these and you actually are pushing the buttons of those tapes and actually playing them again. And it's just emotionally racking. You go through all this to do what? Well, in this case, to learn why you ended up this way. But then what did we do? Well, we spent all the time talking about the people who did that to us, and your mom, your dad, and we're blame and all this crap like this. And the fact was, that's killing the messenger over the message. Your mom, your dad, their behavior is not in you. Your behavior is in you. How you learn to respond to them is the message. When we keep beating up the messenger, it doesn't change the message. You still have the message. That's why you go to the psychologist for 3 years. You've completely dissected your life down. You know exactly why you're here in this place. You have every bit of conscious awareness, and guess what? Your life is still exactly the same as it was before. And the reason is why. The conscious mind learns the way you just talked about. The subconscious mind, that's not how it learns. It doesn't care about that. Why? It's based on habit and repetition, and that's its character for learning. So you can become consciously aware. You can do positive thinking. Yeah, which mind is positive thinking? Well, since it's creative thinking, then positive thinking comes from the conscious mind. Why doesn't it work for most people? Because their conscious mind only controls themselves from 1% to 5% of the time. So positive thinking really doesn't participate a lot in the reprogramming. It's, yeah, but it works for some people. It's like, the reason? They already had belief programs in their subconscious that agreed with that positive thinking. They were just bringing it out. Most of us don't. And so we're talking to ourselves. Positive thinking, I'm going to talk to myself. And then I say, okay, let's stop for a minute now. You just gave yourself a good talking to. Who are you talking to? Who were you talking to? I'm talking to that subconscious. And I'm then all of a sudden say, you know what the joke is here? Is the subconscious is a machine. It's a tape recorder.
Yeah.
It records a behavior, and you push the button, and it plays it back. There's nobody in there. And you're yelling at it a lot. And it's not helping it a lot either, because when it doesn't work out the way we want, then there's a tendency to get mad at ourselves, right? Well, the subconscious mind, this comes back up what I talked about. The subconscious mind is actually like a precocious five-year-old. And it's very important, because here's the failure for a lot of people, is you're trying to give directives to your subconscious mind, which is a five-year-old, in terms that a five-year-old can't understand. They're too subjective, too abstract. You say, I want more money, to your five-year-old. Your five-year-old toddles off to the bedroom, breaks the piggy bank open, comes back with three pennies and says, here. And it's like, oh, it is more money, but it's not exactly. It's like, oh, you left that up to the subconscious mind. What are you, crazy? Subconscious mind doesn't make that decision. You know, you tell your subconscious mind, I want to be happy. Well, what's happy to a five-year-old, a little teddy bear? It's not what you were thinking about. So basically, it says that you must understand, when you really want to communicate with your subconscious, the first thing is all languages have to be committed to that subconscious in the context of a five-year-old's understanding. If you can get a five-year-old to listen to you and understand what you want, then you have the phrase that you really want to tell your subconscious mind. That's number one. Number two, it is like a precocious five-year-old. Why is it relevant? Because the system works very, this is so neat. If you get angry with a child for what it does things, what does the child do in response? It pouts. It goes and runs away, locks itself in its room, hides from you. It doesn't respond to that. But if you respond to a five-year-old child with lovingness and warmth and care, then the five-year-old is like, yeah, I like this. I want more of this. And so whatever you give loving care to your subconscious mind, it will then respond faster to give you more of the same. If you get mad at your subconscious mind, it will, you know, it will be angered and rebel against this. And so why is it important? Because personally, here's what I learned. I learned that rather, you know, I let's say many times in my life, okay, Bruce, you have this sugar addiction. You really got to cut this stuff out and then give myself that good talking to, you know? And so now I've fixed everything up. This is really cool. I just gave the big lecture to this mind. And then 8 minutes later, there I am with a Krispy Kreme donut in my hand. And then now I see the donut in my hand and go, oh my God, you stupid idiot. You couldn't even stop for 8 minutes. And then, of course, you berate yourself and you're getting angry. And guess what? You didn't change anything. You actually made it worse, okay? You know what I found after years of doing that? That I found that all of a sudden, that one day when I started to become more aware of it, it's like I caught myself with a donut in the hand after just having that discussion. And for the first time in my life, I didn't yell at myself and I didn't get mad. I actually stopped for a moment and said, that was good. It was good. What? You caught yourself with the donut in your hand. You had a moment of decision all of a sudden. What you could have said was, oh, good, I got the donut. I thank you for bringing that to my attention. Let's put the donut down. And when I started to respond that way, the mind was so enthusiastic that it would catch me even before touching the donut. And then it would catch me before thinking about the donut, because every time I would come to my conscious mind, oh, cool, I just avoided that. And by giving it, like a five-year-old, a hug and a love, it worked much faster. And then you go and look at our conventional way, which is my way, the old way, was getting that mad and upset with yourself and realizing it never gets better doing that.
So part of what I'm hearing is bringing consciousness. Now, Bruce, we have another question, too. What do you think of the superconscious?
Well,
Michael is asking, how would you term that? Is that, would that be the conscious mind or the consciousness?
It is, to me, that is the spiritual field communication, whatever is going on in the field that is interpreted by your conscious mind as identity and the reality that you see. That's really more or less the superconsciousness. So I would put superconsciousness as that ability to have awareness and consciousness when you're not even embodied. And that's where people go when they have their intuitive hits. So it's like you didn't get an intuitive hit in the body. You got an intuitive hit outside the body. You were using your awareness on a much greater level of consciousness outside of the body in the bigger field of awareness than the consciousness that is your own piece that gets isolated when it gets inside your head.
So aligning our conscious mind into that superconscious or the field, becoming aware of that which we are, aligning to that. Now, one question I wanted to ask you was about the, because I found this fascinating in the in your Spontaneous Evolution CD, was the idea about the creator cells. And I was likening it to how we have the cultural creatives, which used to be about, I don't know, 8 to 10%, 10 percentile of the population, which from listening to your CD set, that apparently that's higher now. But that we have these creative cells within us already, and that we are already programmed on some level or on a cellular level for our evolution, our next evolution.
We were programmed for our evolution from the very beginning. What we didn't have were teachers that allowed us to get into the program. And in fact, there were teachers originally that did allow us to get in the program. Now, I wasn't raised in the Christian tradition, but then you just go back to one of the teachers, and of course, Jesus. And what did he say? He said, you know those miracles that I do? You could do them better than I can do them. You don't believe it. And this is what his teaching was. Basically, he's saying, look, you're a creator, I'm a creator. You're a creator that doesn't believe it, and therefore you're not creating from your own belief system. You can't get any more fundamental than that, because no matter what all the science and the quantum physics and the cell biology and all the proteins and all that stuff come down to is, you are the creator and you create with your belief. You've been programmed to have disempowering beliefs by those people that have taken advantage of the power while taking the power away from you. And so we live in a world where we're units of power, but we're controlled by other people's belief systems. And why is this relevant? Because I want to tell you right now, here's a simple truth. We just take a survey, and you could go to any country in the world, anywhere, right now, and you just go out to the people on the street out there and you say, listen, would you like to be healthy or unhealthy? Oh, I want to be healthy. Would you like to be happy? Yes, I would love to be happy. Would you like to have peace on this planet? Sure, I'd love to have peace on this planet. And you start to realize, you know that the mass number of 6 billion people have the same belief system, that their belief system is to live here with peace and harmony and happiness? And then I say, well, if we're creating the world, then how come we have so much difficulty? The answer is because we've been disempowered from exercising those belief systems and buy into the belief systems provided by a few. And their beliefs then, because we've been programmed to accept their beliefs over our beliefs, their beliefs run our civilization. And the evolution that's coming upon us right now is the recognition that, A, beliefs are causing this, B, that we've been primarily living from beliefs that are propagated down from generation to generation that control our genetics, our behavior, life on this planet, and that we must undo that programming and reinstall it with programs of our own. It doesn't mean the subconscious is a bad thing, because it really gets a bad rap, because we always blame the evilness of life from the subconscious. Well, the subconscious is a machine. It's like, is that tape player good or evil?
Well, I know, I always say it's like a computer. You can't get angry at your computer. If you want to do, you know, airbrushing and you don't have Photoshop, you can't yell at the machine. You got to put the software in, right?
You have to do the programming part. Right now, we buy the programs from others. Are you able to heal yourself? No. You are a victim. Okay. Can you create that joy and happiness? No, you're living in a struggle for your survival in this competition, you know, for our existence here. And it's like, oh, okay. Tell me these other things about my life so I can live it. And so we buy all these stories, and then we manifest those stories. And you know who doesn't live by the stories? The powerful people.
That's right.
Because they're the ones that know the answer.
Yeah. So in essence, Bruce, and that's the secret, in a sense, you know, what you were saying in your the Biology of Belief book. Now, in a sense, are you saying that... So the empowerment comes from just the wake up is I don't have to buy these into these programs anymore. I don't have to follow these programs. I can and that's
yeah, but that's the wake up.
That's the wake up. Yeah,
that's not the empowerment.
Okay, that's the wake up.
Yeah, that's the intention, and that's why you know that you and I are talking. That's why other people are listening, because we all have intentions of what.
Mm-hmm.
Doing better in our world, in our lives, and seeking those things that we know are available, that love and harmony and that health. We know it's out there because we've all touched it. The question is, it's almost always been just a flitting moment in time when, guess what, that honeymoon that I talked about, for some people lasted a day, some people a week,
yeah.
Some luckier people a year. I am now on my 12th year of my honeymoon. And why? It's because when I understood the nature of the programming, I put in a program, why don't I make that a way of life than any other way of life? So I put in those essence into my subconscious, and now it's an automatic process. I don't have to work on a honeymoon. When I'm not paying attention, it automatically plays honeymoon.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what we have to do. So the question is, how do you go from intention to realization?
Mm-hmm.
And that is, okay, I got the intention of what I really want, but now how do I get it into the program? That has been the difficult part.
The actualization.
And it's only been a difficult part because we were trying to use the conventional knowledge at the time to try to make those changes. And the wonderful part in our evolution is now we're being provided with technologies and processes that can accelerate these changes, that we can create changes in belief systems within minutes through hypnosis, through NLP, through energy psychology, learning the process of how does the subconscious learn? And by pushing the record button rather than talking to it, we can engage a process. And so, unfortunately, there's so many new processes, and I have them listed on my website, brucelipton.com. There's a category on the website called Resources, and there's all ways in there of taking conscious control over your life and reprogramming it, including various forms of energy psychology, hypnotherapy, Buddhist mindfulness training techniques, the use of affirmations. But now I really just want people to understand that, because sometimes people say, oh, I write that and I put it in my refrigerator.
Yeah.
And I say, that's not the use of affirmations. That's a sign on the wall sometimes.
Yeah. I agree.
Doesn't matter
how many post-it notes you put, if that programming is not changed, I don't care how many post-its you put.
Right.
Well,
and it doesn't change by just looking at the picture. It changes by you actively engaging in the programming of those belief systems. So it becomes a more religious phenomenon.
And I would expound on that, Bruce, is that the more people do it, whether it's the hypnotherapy, alpha theta healing, whatever energetic shifting, NLP, the more you do it, you learn how to do it yourself. You can go to a practitioner.
It's a field effect.
Yeah.
It's like Hunter's Monkey as well. Yeah, the more they do it, the easier it is to do it. And that's why, guess what? The number of people that are listening to your show are increasing all the time, because there are more people who are in the field that are being, you know, becoming incorporated and entangled into the field and pulled into this, because it is a necessary mode of our evolution. It'll propagate from one person to the next person.
That's right. We're the field, and we're affecting the field, and that's where our empowerment comes, and knowing that we are shifting it. Bruce, this has been wonderful. Sharing. I'm so glad
this
that you
30 minutes the- went by really fast.
Oh, I really, you know, I'm telling you, the book, it is, if you, you know, everyone that's listening and those that will be listening to the archive, if you really want to tap into your infinite possibilities and just the idea of possibilities, I really do recommend The Biology of Belief, the book, and also Spontaneous Evolution. I have the CD. I put it on while I'm doing other stuff and just absorb. I allow this into my personal field, you know, just absorb the insight and the information, and the energy that comes from this is just amazing. Very transformative, Bruce. Absolutely.
Thank you, Michelle. Thank you. I want to really just thank the listeners, because as we talked about, the listeners are the equivalent of the imaginal cells that help the caterpillar transition from a caterpillar into a butterfly. They are the genetically identical cells of the caterpillar, but think differently. And their thinking created a new structure of evolution. And the people on this line are the imaginal cells.
Right.
They're looking for a new pattern, a new evolution, and everyone is involved.
That's right.
Evolution.
And that's so empowering that we are all involved. If you'd like to contact Dr. Bruce Lipton, you can go to his website, which is brucelipton.com. And, of course, you can re-listen in the archives on Blog Talk Radio as well as iTunes. I'm your host, Michelle Mache. Thanks again for joining us on Awakenings. And until next time, shine your light, share your insight, and keep awake. All the best. Peace and blessings. Thanks, Bruce, so much.
Thank you.